I do think this week something's going to happen. I feel like we're getting close to a resolution on this.
Lawmakers express optimism, but there's no change yet in the legislative stalemate. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, Memorial Day, May 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a celebration after a land donation to the Tionic Tribe.
This land return was done in such a positive way that it shows the good that can come out of returning to a Native community that doesn't have to be divisive.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at FNBAlaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
With negotiations over the state's multi-billion dollar budget deficit still underway, the Alaska House and Senate met in brief and uneventful floor sessions over the weekend. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Because there was no agreement to vote on, every House and Senate floor session lasted minutes. They also canceled all of their Finance Committee hearings. While no public action was taken on the budget, legislative leaders were somewhat optimistic that a deal could soon be reached. Senate President Kevin Meyer, an Anchorage Republican, says there has been some progress between the House's Republican majority and Democratic minority. Meyer says Speaker Mike Chenault has been talking to House Minority Leader Chris Tuck about what Democrats need to support drawing from the Rainy Day Fund.
Their requests are reasonable. I think that the Senate will be amenable. If Mike has to give a lot to get Chris and minority on board, then we could be at this for a while because it'll be a hard sell to the Senate.
In most situations, a three-quarter vote is needed to draw from the state's constitutional budget reserve. Democrats have withheld their support for more than a month in hopes of increasing funding for education and advancing other aspects of their agenda. Last week, the Republican majorities had floated a plan to circumvent the Democrats using a loophole to the three-quarter rule. That threshold drops down to a majority vote if funds in other accounts, like the Permanent Fund Earnings Reserve account, are not available for spending. In a bit of tricky accounting, Republicans had proposed moving money in the Earnings Reserve account to the corpus of the Permanent Fund, so that money would not count against them when taking a vote on the budget reserve. But a group of six majority members opposed that plan out of concern that it could have a negative impact on dividends in years where the stock market was weak. Senator Bill Willikowski, an Anchorage Democrat, says that fracture has reinvigorated the budget compromise.
I do think this week something's going to happen. I feel like we're getting close to a resolution on this.
Lawmakers have until June 1st to pass a budget before layoff notices are sent to state employees, and until July 1st before Alaska experiences a partial government shutdown. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Alaska transportation officials say floodwaters have receded enough for repairs to begin on the Dalton Highway. The Alaska Department of Transportation said yesterday the repairs will reestablish a lifeline to Prudhoe Bay and the North Slope. The ongoing flooding prompted Governor Bill Walker to issue a second disaster declaration late last week. Culverts are being installed on the north end of the highway to allow floodwaters to flow back into the main channel of the Sag River. On the south end, crews will continue to excavate, haul, and stockpile materials necessary for rebuilding miles of washed-out highway. The highway remains closed from mile 335 to mile 413. There's no estimate on when the road will reopen. A woman found dead in a park in Bethel on Sunday has been identified. Bethel Police Lieutenant Joe Corbett says she was from Bethel.
Investigators were able to obtain the identification of the deceased as Eunice Whitman. She is 23 years old. She's from Bethel here. She sustained multiple stab wounds we know of. We don't right now have a complete cause of death without the medical examiner's report and the autopsy, but that obviously looked like a contributor.
Police say witnesses reported the body early yesterday morning, and remains were found around 4 a.m. Investigators from the Alaska State Troopers Alaska Bureau of Investigation were dispatched to the scene from Anchorage and are working with the Bethel Police Department Investigations Unit. Whitman was found in the bushes near the Pinkies Park boardwalk between public housing and the park. On Sunday night, Bethel police identified a suspect, Whitman's boyfriend, Justine Paul.
Investigators were able to identify a suspect in her boyfriend, Mr. Justine Paul. He's also known as Justin Paul. He pronounces it Justin. He's also 24 years old. He originally from Kipnuk, moved to Bethel.
Police say they searched Paul's home and found evidence they believe links him to the murder. A search of Paul was also conducted for trace forensic evidence. Paul, whom police say is a convicted felon, was interviewed and arrested for murder in the first degree. Paul was remanded to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Correctional Center and faces arraignment tomorrow. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a mapping project that could help strengthen future spill response efforts.
The motivation was fairly specific for oil spills affecting birds in the Aleutian Islands.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Tribal, state, and private sector leaders kicked off construction of housing at the Alaska Native Medical Center last week. They say it will improve services for Alaska Native and American Indian people who travel to Anchorage from across the state for health care. A state senator who helped get the project financed says it will also save the state millions of dollars a year for decades to come. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
The new six-story patient housing facility with 202 private rooms will be located behind and linked by Skybridge to the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage, which serves some 150,000 patients a year. More than half of those patients travel to Anchorage for health services, but many can be served as outpatients. They may need to be monitored or receive care for high-risk pregnancies, for instance, or for chemotherapy or post-surgical follow-up. Andy Tuber is board chair and president of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. He says the new facility will cut down on the cost of putting up patients in hotels and make it easier for patients to receive services.
This is one of many barriers that we look forward to breaking down and improving access for our patients across the state to health care here at the ANMC.
Tuber says Congress approved a land transfer from the Indian Health Service, and the consortium worked with the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services and with legislators on financing.
A number of occasions, we found that the enthusiasm around the project was sufficient to carry it through.
That enthusiasm is due in part to the fact the state of Alaska will see an estimated jump of almost $9 million in Medicaid reimbursements annually. Medicaid patients who stay at a tribal facility allow the state to receive 100% of the federal match. If those patients are being seen at a non-tribal facility, the state receives only half the federal match. That's one reason Anchorage Republican and Senate President Kevin Meyer co-sponsored a bill in 2013 that authorized the state to issue bonds to loan ANTHC $35 million, a big chunk of the $41 million price tag for the housing facility.
It was kind of a unique concept, and at first we had some hesitation as to how it would work and what it would truly cost, but it's going to pay itself back in a short period of time, and it was really a good deal for the state financially and certainly a good deal for all the citizens of Alaska. So it's truly a win-win, and happy to be part of it.
Meyer says knowing the Indian Health Service is a major source of funding for the consortium reassured legislators, who he says gave a close look at the level of risk the state was taking on in funding the project.
We did, because ultimately, if the funding source doesn't come through, then it falls back on the state. But you know, it was the federal government, for the most part's pretty trustworthy.
The new housing facility is expected to be completed in the fall of 2016. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Tribal members from the native village of Tyonek recently celebrated a donation of land that once was home to their ancestors. The 160-acre parcel was donated to the people of Tyonek by the Nature Conservancy. The land has former home and food storage sites dating back 900 years. Independent journalist Mark Trahant attended the potlatch held in Tyonek, located on the western shore of Cook Inlet. He says the community appreciated having the land returned to their care from the Nature Conservancy.
Basically, as I understand the story, they saw the land, they saw the cultural identity of the land, and just, I mean, it's really remarkable what's there, and saw that this really had to go back to the Tyonek people and made steps to make that happen.
So tell us, what is there? What did you see?
Well, there's a number of dwelling sites, and they're really clear. What's interesting is, I guess it was USGS, and not quite sure the federal agency now that I think about it. It may have been Army Corps of Engineers, but at any rate, there was an archaeological survey, and they completely missed all this. And the village hired its own archaeological team or worked with another archaeological team just a couple of years ago and immediately came up with this really rich resource, including houses. One of the things that's just stunning are these cold pits that were the original refrigerators for Athabascan people. And they're pretty clearly visible. They're probably the housing units and the pits range from 300 to 900 years old.
How visible are they? Was this discovered after a lot of digging, or how close to the surface are some of these areas?
This time of year, they're actually really visible. I'm told that as the summer progresses and the weeds get higher, it becomes harder to find them. You have to kind of stumble into the hole. But this type of year, it's very visible, and you can see the indention from the homes.
It seems odd that that wasn't noted previously. Do you think it's just a lack of understanding of what they were maybe looking at and not realizing what was in front of them? Or,
I mean, that's the logical, and you'd hope that be the case. The cynical side is that it was under potential development as a coal mine. It's really interesting. When you're on that beach, you see how quickly it would be easy to see the reserves of coal, because the beach is full of coal. You look down and you see, and I thought it was burnt wood. And I said, what's all this? Was there a fire here? And they said, no, that's the coal. And you can see how it was seen as a resource site rather than an archaeological site by those that wanted to develop it.
The land was used as a homestead for a time. It was then donated to the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church donated it to the Conservancy. Did the Conservancy approach Tyonek, or did the Tyonek people reach out to them and say, hey, we'd like this land back?
I think, as I understand the story, it was the Nature Conservancy that approached, and they were dealing with a couple of lawyers from the village on a couple of other areas and saw the opportunity. One thing that the tribe or the village is really struck by is how valuable this piece of ground could have been had it been put on the open market. And so they're just incredibly grateful that they had this opportunity. The president, Al Guzman, talks about it in terms of a lost relative coming home.
Are there limits as to what they can do there? And beyond the culture camp, what kind of plans do they have?
There are limits. There's a conservation easement as part of the deal that they've agreed to, and including long-term relationship monitoring, where there'll be back and forth between primarily the Great Land Trust. That said, there's also the potential, and I would say likelihood, that this could be some of the first lands going into trust into Alaska, because that's also part of the negotiation and certainly a prospect.
Did they talk about that at all, about seeing, about taking some of this land or applying to have some of this land taken into trust?
It's certainly on the radar, and certainly something that will, I think, come to fruition fairly quickly once the regulations are able to go back into effect after the litigation is all set. when you look at trust lands, cultural resources is the highest use. So this fits exactly with what the 1934 Indian Reorganization Act, which was a law designed to restore Indian lands. And this is exactly what they were thinking of in Congress at the time.
Beyond this 160 acres being donated to Tyonek, what else about this is significant? And what do you think it means going forward for perhaps other tribes in Alaska?
Well, I think this land return was done in such a positive way that it shows the good that can come out of returning to a Native community that doesn't have to be divisive. It doesn't have to be a contentious issue. It can be about the future and inspire people. And I know I came away awfully inspired by it.
Mark Trahant is the former Atwood Chair for Journalism at the University of Alaska Anchorage. His reporting on the Tyonek land donation is at TrahantReports.com. Groundwater contamination at Eielson Air Force Base may have spread off the facility. The Air Force has contacted private property owners in the nearby Moose Creek area offering to test well water for presence of a chemical presumed to be from firefighting foam formerly used at the base. Eric Breitenberger, a manager with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation Contaminated Sites Program, says there's already known to be extensive pollution at Eielson.
There's a fairly large groundwater plume of perfluorinated compounds, and we know that it extends to the northern boundary of the base. We don't know yet if it extends beyond the base boundary, but that's the concern, and that's why the Air Force is planning to sample residential drinking water wells in the Moose Creek subdivision.
Breitenberger says the Air Force previously abandoned some older base wells that tested in excess of an Environmental Protection Agency provisional health advisory level for perfluorinated compounds.
The one in particular is called PFOS, perfluoroctane sulfonate, and it's an emerging contaminant. And what we mean by an emerging contaminant is that we have very limited data on toxicity, and particularly with regards to human health effects. Most of the health effects that we know about are based on animal studies.
The studies show blood, liver, and kidney effects. Breitenberger says firefighting suppression foams containing PFOS were used from 1970 to 2000. He says perfluorinated compounds are known to readily spread.
These perfluorinated compounds are very resistant to degradation. They last a long time in the groundwater, so the groundwater plumes can be very extensive.
Breitenberger adds that perfluorinated compounds are in a range of industrial and commercial products and have also been detected in groundwater at other interior sites, including the Flint Hills North Pole Refinery, but not in excess of the advisory level. The DEC is overseeing the water testing of Moose Creek wells. Eielson is a federal Superfund site regulated by the DEC and EPA.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the Promise Tuition Grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
A scientist and entrepreneur is leading a mapping project to find out where potential oil spills could have the worst effects on seabirds. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has the story.
Martin Rena owns Turnigan Consulting, based in Homer, and has a background in biology. A little more than 2 years ago, Fish and Wildlife Service got a grant and contracted him.
The motivation was fairly specific for oil spills affecting birds in the Aleutian Islands.
His job was to collect and collate data on bird population density and shipping traffic in the Aleutians and find out where they overlap the most.
And you could interpret it both as for the risk of a large catastrophic oil spill or for the risk of chronic oil pollution that Yeah, it's just a byproduct of any kind of industrial shipping activity.
Basically, if there are a lot of ships traveling through a single area, that raises the likelihood of a spill there. That's particularly dangerous if, say, there's a large summer nesting population of seabirds in the same spot. Rena calls those places choke points.
The main choke point is in Unimak Pass, near Dutch Harbor. We already know that there are high densities of seabirds, both in summer and in winter, and every vessel that travels through the Bering Sea between east and west really needs to go through this one pass.
That was something he expected to find. Something he didn't expect was a buildup of vessels and birds just south of Sand Point near the shelf break.
Well, the data all existed before, but there was no analysis to really put it all together.
Rena says he did some of the data collection, but most of it came from observations going back decades. The bird data is based on at-ship surveys with observers on research and container vessels. They counted birds 10 minutes at a time and used GPS to mark their locations. For the ship data, Rena says they were interested in large ocean-going ships like container vessels that carry a lot of fuel and could cause a large spill. Many of those ships have automated equipment that radios in their position with a weather report. He developed a mapping tool that put those two virtual maps on top of each other. The new map will inform oil spill mitigation efforts in the future.
And there are now plans to put more response gear into the Aleutians, like into Dutch Harbor, like offshore tugboats, by having more data on where those critical areas are, would allow us to make more informed decisions on strategically placing those resources.
His map not only found new choke points, it showed that some old ideas on good places to put equipment and response gear weren't actually that useful. For example, there had been plans to possibly station a tug in Adak.
It's fairly clear that Adak would not be an ideal spot because it's far away from concentration of shipping traffic, and it's also not really at the heart of the main seabird densities. You'd have to travel several days from Adak to get to a likely position, whereas at Sand Point you'd be within an hour's of striking distance.
Rene says this project is just one piece of a larger ongoing effort to utilize current technology to process information from the past and hopefully better protect vulnerable species in an environment that's getting busier and more industrialized every day. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
What is it like to be in a classroom of just two students? That was the reality for Klukwan high schoolers this year. Klukwan is a Tlingit village about 20 miles north of Haines. Some teens there choose to go to bigger schools in Haines, Sitka, or Juneau, but two did not. KHNS's Emily Files talked to those students and their teacher about their experiences at the 13-student K-12 school.
Senior Caitlin Stevens and junior Joseph Lamberty are the only two students in their class at Klukwan School this year. Lamberty lives in Mosquito Lake. Stevens lives in Klukwan. She says when she first started school here, there were more kids. It slowly shrunk over the years.
It's pretty sad. Not a lot of people wanted to stay here because it was so small.
A lot of kids get to a point where they just want to have athletics and clubs and activities, and as much as we try, we can't offer everything a big school has to offer here.
That's Carson Buck, Klukwan's 6th through 12th grade teacher. He said last year he had 9 students. This year it's just 2. Buck says once students get older, a lot of them transfer from Klukwan to Haines School, Mount Edgecombe Boarding School in Sitka, or a Juneau school. But Stevens and Lamberty stayed. Lamberty says some days, if the weather is nice, he, Stevens, and Mr. Buck will go skip rocks on the river or just go on a walk. Or if there's something they need extra time on, they can shift around their schedule. With only 2 students, the teaching can be super individualized.
There have been many times where I wished I was in a big school because I like it a lot here. I like having the one-on-one attention, and it's easier to get work done.
Stevens did try going to a bigger school her sophomore year. She went to Mount Edgecombe for a semester, but she says it was difficult to keep on track. She wasn't learning the way she does here, so she came back her second semester. Their teacher has also helped keep them here.
I might have switched schools had Mr. Buck not been teaching here, but he's an awesome teacher, so
yeah,
that was like a pretty big part of the decision.
That's great to hear. I see them in sixth grade when they're 12 years old, and I see them leave at 18, so we're kind of, you get pretty attached. They're almost like your own kids after a while.
Buck is from Haines, and he started teaching in Clukwan in 2008. The small number of students means he can really help them on a one-to-one level, but it's not all good.
It's bad in that, you see the same kids every day for 6-7 years straight, and they need variety, and I think it's good that they're both moving on. I can only give them so much. They need to have other experiences besides one teacher, so that's the dark side of it.
Buck says they try to expose the students to as much as possible outside of school walls and village boundaries. Stevens is a senior this year. She's graduating and going to University of Alaska Southeast in Juneau to study biology. She hopes to become a physical therapist.
My grandma, her shoulder was hurt, and she needed help with her exercises one night, and I helped her, and I've been wanting to do that ever since because I like helping people.
Lamberty is a junior, but he won't be finishing high school in Clukwan next year. He's moving to Oregon, where most of his family lives. He says the high school he'll attend there has about 100 students, much more than he's used to. But he says he's not too worried about that. As for Buck, his position at the school is being cut. Principal Nancy Moon says the needs of the school will be mainly elementary students next year. Buck says teaching at Clukwan School wasn't always easy, but
it was a really good time, and there's a sense of community here that I haven't felt anywhere else. Growing up in Haines, I didn't really get to know the people of Clukwan that well, and was never really a part of the community, but since teaching here, it was a really, really good experience.
Reporting from Clukwan, I'm Emily Files.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton in Bethel, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, and Emily Files in Clukwan. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Join Alaska Public Media for a talk by boreal herbalist Beverly Gray on May 29th at 7 p.m. at Alaska Pacific University. Gray is the author of the national best-selling and award-winning book, The Boreal Herbal, Wild Food and Medicine Plants of the North. Gray explains the benefits of wild herbs and how they can best be incorporated into our everyday lives. Tickets and more information at alaskapublic.org, sponsored by Alaska Pacific University, a benefit for Alaska Public Media.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.